590 The Fan. JD, Blake, and Ailish. It's hard to find things that are going well for a team that's up 3-2 in a series. Honest to God, this is wild. Raptors fans are doing the strangest things on Twitter, celebrating things at first like, aha, Shaq, we didn't get swept like you said we would. You were wrong. And now it's full tilt kind of turned into the Raps are just going to walk away with the series. Spike Eskin is the co-host of the Rights to Ricky Sanchez podcast. He's not there yet. Just heard that. Setting up a guy. It's not there yet. Okay. I'll pause. I'll reset that. But yes, it is wild to see the shift in tone around this series from we did the first couple of games ago. You know what? We really should have respected the Sixers more as contenders. They have Joel Embiid. He could end up being the best player in any series. He's arguably the most unguardable guy remaining. Physical freak. He looks like he's in great condition. Think about all the conditioning plaudits that this guy got, and rightfully so. He played a full regular season, he looked great, and now he looks like he's gassing out in the third quarter, and rightfully so if he has to play this many minutes. But all of a sudden we went from, wow, the Sixers are getting such great contributions from guys around the lineup, wow, look at them go, they're getting good Tobias Harris, they're getting good Tyrese Maxey, but beyond that even, their Niang looks dangerous, all this stuff. And now everything has shifted. Like, every single thing in this series has shifted. It's been incredible to watch. Let's talk about it with someone that probably doesn't feel like it's incredible. Spike Eskin, co-host of the Rights to Ricky Sanchez podcast, a Sixers-focused podcast. He joins us now. Spike, what's the more troubling quote? Joel Embiid on his thumb? Joel Embiid on James Harden's lack of aggression? Or Doc Rivers and his excuse-laden ramble about blowing 3-1 leads?
Oh man, you asked me to rank. It's like picking my favorite meal.
There are hits here. They're all hits in Toronto. Like, that's actually what, no one's listening to the show. People are just listening to other stations that are playing those three quotes over and over and over again.
I would say, if you made me rank them, believe it or not, I would pick the Embiid one about the Harden lack of aggression. Mm. It not because of Harden, which I've grown to know, I'm actually not particularly surprised, but it's just something that we've heard from Joel about other players before, and you just sort of start to wonder, like, why that seems to happen repeatedly to the Sixers with his teammates, right? Like, I sort of want Joel to grab whoever he wants to be aggressive and not tell the coach to tell him aggressive, but grab him in the middle of the game. You know, there's that famous, little clip that you see of Draymond Green sort of screaming at Kevin Durant that he's the guy and he's got to do it. I want Joel Embiid to grab James Harden if he wants him to be more aggressive, and in mid-game scream at him and say, be more aggressive, and maybe that'll do something.
I really like that, and I hadn't really thought about that way, but I have thought this before. I've thought, man, Joel Embiid seems sort of passive-aggressive at times during games. Like, when things aren't going great, a guy who doesn't necessarily always stand in the huddle, a guy who doesn't always kind of seem like the vocal leader of a team, and yeah, to be kind of talking about a teammate through the media that way, everyone has already accepted that Ben Simmons is the villain, and that, of course, because he is a villain, he's a massive loser. Like, that's sure. Just a fact. But but I'm looking at this now, and I'm saying, you're really talking about a teammate in the media, and then doing the whole, he's got to shoot more, but I'm not the coach, and then kind of trying to be half-hearted about it. A year removed from a teammate leaving your team because you were talking about him in the media during the series, it kind of does, I feel like maybe he is skating a little bit from the accountability standpoint of this.
Yeah, to be clear, I think Embiid has been truly unbelievable this year. You know, like, I think he should be the MVP and best player in offense, best player in defense, all of those things. But there is a certain, and there has been a certain front runner quality to him, to where when things are going well, he appears to be truly the most unstoppable force in the league. But then when things aren't going well, his body language is not great, and the things in the media happen. And, you know, it was part of why, you know, I was actually sort of glad when Jimmy Butler left, but it was part of why it was good to have somebody of that personality, because it might be that Embiid, while he's a great player, isn't a great vocal leader and isn't a great, you know, motivator of other players. And unfortunately, Harden isn't really that either. So, you know, the only thing I would say is that there have been moments during this series, specifically game three, where things were not going well for Embiid and not going well for the team, and he seemed to throw the entire team on his back and sort of battle back from that. And you do sort of wonder where, I'm not giving him an excuse, but wonder where the thumb injury has almost sapped him of motivation, or sapped him of belief, or wherever it is. But it was a very strange Embiid we saw in game five, especially defensively. And then I agree with you that quote afterwards is not great.
No. And again, the thumb part is him saying that he's thinking about protecting his thumb during the game frequently. And I went, well, that's not good. Maybe that explains the defense. Maybe it's that he's a little worn down throughout the series. Because to me, that's always the fear with the guys. We know what he looks like when, you're right, when he's being in a front runner position and when he gets to get his rest properly. But it was pretty bad that Precious Achiuwa is just attacking him without any reservation. And that Pascal Siakam is going at him at OG. And it just, when there was that moment in the third quarter where every single Raptors forward basically took a turn attacking Embiid and it worked out. I didn't feel great about that. I wouldn't feel great about that if I'm a Sixers fan. But okay, so we've said Embiid, he can be great. We know that. And I agree with you. I think that he was the MVP this season. So do you think that there's a path to victory here? This is a weird thing to say, but is there a path to victory for the team that's up 3-2 in this series that at this point is not just Embiid takes over this game after an extra day of rest, dominates, and the pieces around him kind of work? Like, do you actually believe there's any other game script where the Sixers come out on top?
Do I believe? I guess intellectually I could tell you that I think that if offensively they stop relying on Embiid post position and run a little more pick and pop with Harden and Embiid to get him open jumpers and maybe not rely on him physically as much, I think there's a path. And I think also, you know, this is what was maddening about game five. Like, the Raptors don't even have any guards. It's just you wonder if the Raptors just don't, like, it seems like it's a struggle for them in half court, you know, offensively. So if the Sixers can do a better job, and preventing those runouts and a better job not turning the ball over, that they can prevent the Raptors from scoring. But really, at the end of the day, I guess this is a long way to say no. I think that the way that this has to happen is Embiid has to come in and say, I'm not going to be the leader of the first team in NBA history to blow a 3-0 lead. And thumb or no thumb, I don't know what's going to happen next series, but I'm not letting this series go away. And it should. I mean, this is a league that comes down to the best players on the best teams. And, you know, history will look upon this series as Embiid's failure, not anybody else's. You know, if they lose this series, it will stick to him. Doc Rivers already has failures. Harden already has failures. I think history knows what they think of those two players, but this will stick to Embiid for a long time. So I think really when it comes down to it, it's up to him.
So it being up to him, I think, is, and this being framed correctly, in my estimation, that it's got to be an Embiid dominance game, says a lot about where James Harden is at and how this entire experiment has gone. 22 points, the highest he scored in the series, hasn't scored more than 22 in 11 games now. Why is this not working as well as maybe we thought on paper with the James Harden, Joel Embiid dynamic, at least when teams force James Harden to be the scoring version of James Harden, as the Raptors have progressively done over the course of the series?
He can't get by anyone, you know, like, it's pretty obvious. There was one possession in the third quarter, and we've seen this over and over and over again with Harden, you know, in the couple of months he's been here in different games, but there was one particularly disturbing sequence. And I think it was in the third quarter where Harden does this thing where he just will ask for picks until he gets switches until he gets the mismatch that he wants.
I know exactly the possession you're going to reference here. It's hilarious.
This is so he goes through Raptor after Raptor, and I think he went through three or four of them, and he was like, all right, this is the guy that I want. I guess I can't get by him. Let's get another guy. And he went through the whole, like, every one, and he couldn't get by any of them. And, you know, when you are in the NBA, when everyone is so fast, if you are 10% slower than you used to be, that makes an enormous difference. And he does, whether it's the hamstring or not, and, you know, if it's a hamstring and you're 32, 33 years old, that a hamstring injury that's lasted 2 years, that's not great either. He can't get by players. And when he doesn't have the lift that he used to have. So he's terrified of getting a shot blocked at the rim, which is why you sort of see him fling things up and either try to get fouled or surprise the other team about when he's going to lay it up. And without the threat of that happening, all of a sudden that step back is not as open as it was, and it ruins his entire game. And you just see when players are defending him, they're not scared of him anymore. You're talking about a player that was so dominant at one point that they used to just guard him from behind, you know, to try to figure out a way, like, wow, guard him on this right side from behind, and he was so unguardable at one point. They were trying anything to stop him, and now you just look at players that are anyone, power forward, centers, nobody's scared of him at all, and I think it's because he just doesn't have that first step, and he doesn't have that burst that he had, and he's still helpful, right? I mean, you can tell the difference between Maxey, when Maxey's on the court with Harden, and he's on the court without Harden, he's much better when he's on the court with Harden. He's still a great passer, all those things, but I just think he's not aggressive because he knows he can't score, and it certainly, you know, past this season creates a really difficult decision for the Sixers.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you next. Is he's 32, he'll be 33 before next season starts. You mentioned the hamstring thing. I can't speak for this myself, but, you know, we've got JD over here using his muscle or his massage gun in between segments because he's in his 30s and the hamstrings don't recover like they used to. But I'm not paying JD $47 million on a player option next year.
Rude.
And I'm not sorry, man, and I'm not looking down a 5-year extension like mega max deal given Harden's service time. The Daryl Morey James Harden relationship is obviously a big factor here, but if you're the 76ers and this is the version of James Harden you're getting in a playoffs where you acquired him and you tried to make sure, hey, you're heading into the playoffs in a good spot physically, in a good spot mentally. Does this have the potential to be a 1.5 and done with Harden and the 76ers? Or is it, no matter what, a conclusion that he'll be around until, you know, until whatever the next contract is runs out?
I wish I had a better answer than I don't know. I think that if you were able to get, and there was talk of Bradley Beal before the trade deadline, and if you can somehow find a way between Harris's contract and whatever future picks they have left to trade and somehow get Beal in there and make it so Harden is not the primary, you know, scorer, I think that becomes a little more tenable. But if you can't, it's going to be a really interesting decision for Morey, because we go back, and this is, you know, Sixers history, but when they traded up for that number one pick, when Brian Colangelo did, and they worked out Markelle Fultz, they knew something was wrong with Markelle Fultz, but they were too scared publicly to pivot and say, we made a mistake here, we can't pick this guy. And it ended up as an enormous disaster. And I do wonder if Morey can look at it honestly from a, you know, a neutral perspective, given his history, throw his history with Harden out the window, throw what he traded for Harden out the window, and say, I just saw what this guy really is. I know I made a big trade for him, but I can't double down on that error by giving him 5 years and $250 million. And we'll see what Morey is willing to take publicly if he just, you know, Harden could even walk this if he didn't opt in. So Harden could walk this summer. And if Morey is willing to let him walk because he doesn't want to give him that deal, it will be high drama this summer no matter what happens.
Yeah. I think Daryl Morey is going to convince himself that Harden was just out of shape. My thing is, Harden, you're learning what all of us learn when we're in our 30s, which is you can't get out of shape and just bounce back in a week. Like, that doesn't happen anymore. Like, yeah, that's over for you. And he's just unfortunately learning it in front of, you know, the entire world and a Sixers fan base that is losing their minds watching him as he, like you said, has no lift and has no real first step like he used to. And that brings me to this. If you could go, if it's just you, right? Obviously not Daryl Morey. He loves James Harden, like to the he loves him so much that we all are just like, oh, I think you guys, I think you want Smooch. I think you love him. He's your favorite guy. Yeah. He's your number one candy baby. Like, you love him so much. I can't actually wait until Daryl. I want to almost hear what the spin is if they lose this series from him directly on what he thought of James's final, what he thought of the playoffs. If it's you, would you rather, knowing what you know now, you get this information, right? Knowing what you know now, do you think you were better off with the Buddy Hield slash De'Aaron Fox potential combination of players that was going to come from Sacramento?
I'll hedge a little bit in that I don't really like De'Aaron Fox, like, at all.
Who does?
So if the deal was Tyrese Halliburton and Buddy Hield or something, then yes. You could look at any deal, honestly, that the Sixers were staring down that we all laughed at that might have been better. Like, there was a C.J. McCollum and Robert Covington idea. There was the Sacramento idea. There was, what was the other one? I don't know. I don't think De'Aaron Fox is a real winning player either, but at least you figure you could trade De'Aaron Fox again, right? If you get him here and he's not as good as you want, he's still young, you still convince somebody else. I don't know that you're convincing anybody to take Harden off your hands at this point. So I'll hedge and say maybe not De'Aaron Fox, but there had to be another deal out there that was more more valuable than this one was.
So if the Raptors are able to come back home tonight, get a win, you know, things are firing for them with the Raptors defense dominating, with the depth that seems to be giving them an edge, the home court, which I'm sure will be giving them a little bit of a push as well. What do you think that atmosphere will be like at Wells Fargo going into game 7? Is that an advantage for Raptors or an advantage for Sixers?
Emailing with Zach Lowe from ESPN this morning about the potential for Game 7, and I said that that crowd will be the most psychotic crowd I've ever – and I'm born and raised in Philadelphia, right? 45 years old, seen a lot of psychotic crowds. I don't even know. All I know is that there will be a lot of energy, and that energy – will shift on a dime as to how it is directed and who it is directed to. And I think that there's a possibility that it could be an intimidating crowd to the Raptors, right? I mean, because there will be a lot of energy, and I think the crowd will want a Sixers win. But if we have a start like we've had over the last couple of games and the Sixers were to lose that game, I would find another way out of the arena than they normally leave, because that crowd will turn on them in a deserved way. By the way, I don't see anything wrong with getting booed. You're up 3-0, and you come back home for Game 7 after potentially losing 3 in a row in the way that they've lost them. I think, you know. And by the way, if Precious Achiuwa hits one more free throw, we could be looking at a closeout game for the Raptors tonight, you know, depending on how things went. So I think that is a very crazy crowd that could turn on the Sixers very quickly.
Spike, thank you, first of all, for specifying Zach Lowe of ESPN. You know, no, do you want to pick up that name you just dropped, or what do you want to do?
No. I don't. You're in Canada. It's like a different world to me. You may
Zach
have a
Lowe's
whole other Zach
Canadian
Lowe that everybody
point.
Knows.
So just quickly before we let you go. So I did a thing with Andrew Unterberger at Rights of Ricky Sanchez before the series, and he was kind of shocked at the respect and reverence I was giving the good version of the 76ers, because he was much less confident in this Sixers team than I, as someone who fears Joel Embiid, was. Was there ever a point in this series where you guys got comfortable and confident?
Yeah. Yeah, after the Embiid game winner in game three. Yeah, for sure. I think like we all went into it scared, and I think part of why that is you just – you don't watch the Sixers as much as we do, and we're so broken as a fan base that all we do is see the bad stuff. And we don't watch the Raptors as much as you do, so all we know is that every time Joel Embiid faces them, it seems like there's 17 Raptors like double-teaming him at once. We don't even know how it happens, and there's that constant fear. But I think after watching games one and two where the Sixers looked very in control, and then game three where they didn't look in control at all but still pulled it off, especially in a way that we had always waited for, you know, with Embiid hitting a game-winning shot. I think I was, and I'm never confident, I was like, oh, this team's not as good as I thought they were with the Raptors. But now I don't think there's anybody in Philadelphia that's confident at all. But after to quickly answer your question, after the game winner in game three, I think we all thought it was over.
All right. Spike, thanks so much for taking the time this morning, man. And Raptors fans, if you're looking for a heck of a tee up for game six, the episode of the Rights of Ricky Sanchez podcast on game five was excellent. Also, big fan of the Carl Landry Record Club, Spike. So keep up all the great work, and thanks for taking time this morning.
Thank you. Yeah, we get a lot of opposing fans listening to us cry after losing games. So we welcome Raptors fans to bathe in our tears afterwards. So thank you all for having me.
Spike Eskin, co-host of the Rights of Ricky Sanchez podcast and the Carl Landry Record Club, all sorts of stuff. Boy, is that going to be a podcast if the Raptors win tonight. There's going to be a lot more on the Raptors later in the show, of course. It's a big game tonight. But first, it's time for something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Yum, yum, yum. Okay, let's see if I can redeem myself from an awful A-list that was so dark.
The worst A-list,
okay,
by the way.
Somebody did text that in. I'm sorry. I apologize. So, something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats. There was an interesting study done with NHL fan bases over the last little while about which fan base drinks the most alcohol while watching their team. Mm-hmm. The winning team, an average of 3.9 drinks per game. Toronto Maple Leaf fans!
That says all you need to know about Canadian people, just in general, that you called the most beer drinkers the winning team.
They won the Stanley Cup for drinking.
It's like, they're like, the people who did the survey were like, this was a survey, not a contest. And Leaf fans are like, we did it. We're number one.
They surveyed fans all over the league, and the most amount of drinks per game, Toronto Maple Leafs, followed by the Blackhawks, Tampa Bay Lightning, Avalanche, and Coyotes. Coyotes makes sense to be in the top five because you got to drink to enjoy that game. But the Leafs being number one poses the question of, are Leafs fans drinking because of their tortured past, or are they drinking because it's a fun social experiment? Who knows? And the average age that was responding to this is interesting for you too, which was 35 years old. So have you now made it into the age of people that respond to surveys?
No comment.
No comment. That's a.
Are you surveyed?
I am. No, I like. I'm definitely in the age. That's the thing. It's like I'm bad with stuff like this. Like even when they do the, hey, you can win money if you just do this survey. I never do it, but I am of, I think, the age now where you think about things and you go, I think I'm starting to trend into the age of I would write a letter. You know, like I should take a letter. Yes. Wow. Why are you booing me? I'm right. Let's take a break. We'll come back and plenty more show. We have Ben Nicholson-Smith, Sportsnet, co-host of the At the Letters podcast, MLB editor. That's next. We'll ask him about the updates to a whole bunch of guys that look like they're on the mend. It's the Fan Morning Show. JD Blake and Ailish, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Smart takes on the biggest stories in sports. The Fan Drive Time with Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sports at 590, The Fan, Blake Murphy, J.D. Buckles, Ailish Forsbar, Deke playing us in with a little Alexis on Fire. Fun, fun show last night. Very fun. Also fun, Ben Nicholson Smith, MLB editor at Sportsnet, co-host of the At the Letters podcast. Ben, how are you this morning, man?
Doing great. Good to be talking some baseball with you guys.
You always sound so cheerful. It's great. It's you know, the 7 and 7:30 a.m. guests aren't always high energy and certainly aren't always cheerful. So it's always
cheerful,
nice to have
even
you on,
when
buddy.
The Blue Jays are on a one game losing streak.
I think it might be their longest losing streak of the year. Have they lost two in a row?
I don't know, but it feels like things are changing in the stadium. Big blowout. Jays fans are nervous. We're going today, hopefully, to change the vibes.
Well, nice. They have not lost to. They have not lost consecutive games this year. So that's something in your favor.
Okay.
So Ben, last night they do lose 7-1 to the Red Sox. Obviously, they're coming off two pretty good wins, and this is baseball. You're not going to win every time out. Was there anything you took from that one? I personally was a little disappointed that, you know, Michael Wacha comes in with a good performance so far, but every indicator pointing to this guy is not pitching as well as his ERA, and he just kind of cruises there through the Jays lineup other than Springer at the top. Anything to pull from that one on the negative side for you, or just one of those nights?
Yeah, mostly one of those nights. You know, on the negative side, it's a night where their offense didn't show up. I think it's a night where you miss Teoscar Hernandez and Danny Jansen. On the pitching side, certainly to have Ross Stripling give you five innings was good. And he really, I mean, he was, to his credit, really aggressive in the strike zone against the Red Sox, throwing fastballs in the zone against a very good lineup, and they took a lot of them. They were pretty passive against him, and he just kept coming at them with his fastball, got some swing and miss above the zone. So, you know, Stripling, I liked what I saw from him. Offensively, there really wasn't much. It looked like the Jays kind of dodged a bit of a scare with that foul ball off Vladdy's foot. And, yeah, it's just one of those games that, you know, at the end of the season, I don't think we're going to be reflecting back on this one for very long.
So you mentioned Ross Stripling, so let's stay positive for a second here. So he, third time getting the start, and obviously he does four innings each of the first two times, skates through a bit of trouble yesterday to give you five, stretched out as far as 84 pitches. I know that we're almost at the end of this 30-31 stretch and that they've changed the roster restrictions to allow you to have up to 14 pitchers beyond this weekend, if you so choose. Where is your comfort level right now on Stripling? Hey, you can get five out of him every fifth time through the order.
Yeah, it's there. I think that as long as he's on and, you know, attacking hitters within the zone, which is certainly what he's done year after year, then absolutely he can give you five innings. It's easy to forget, too. And I've had people with the team make this point to me that, you know, as recently as last August, like he was competing with Steven Matz for that for that starter job on the Jays. And Matz goes out and signs for $40 million. And then, you know, you kind of forget about Stripling from that point on. But, you know, he's a capable major league starter for sure. He's not going to be your Kevin Gausman necessarily or your Jose Berríos, but he's definitely a capable starter. And so, yeah, to me, the biggest question in this rotation is more Hyunjin Ryu and when he returns and what he looks like than it is Stripling at this point.
Yeah, 100%. I actually love Stripling in this role as he's your sixth starter. That means that's a lot of – that bodes well for you because he's shown that he's really good at this job. But from a ceiling standpoint, you know what it is. The ceiling question is about Ryu. And, okay, it looks like he's supposed to be back soonish. I know we'll hit on a couple of guys' updates because, yeah, Teoscar took BP and how long that timeline is, where Jansen is, Nate Pearson's throwing. But Ryu still remains the fascination point because we're not sure whether it's an injury or whether he's done or whether he's completely lost it between the ears. Have you any type of update on where you think the Blue Jays think he's at?
Well, he's eligible to come back. Right. At this point, he's spent his 10 days on the IL. So, you know, he threw a bullpen, what's today, Thursday. So he threw a bullpen Tuesday. And when I asked Charlie Montoyo yesterday what the next steps were, they hadn't determined that. So, you know, is that another bullpen session? Does he do a rehab start? Does he just get tossed back into the rotation at some point? I mean, he has been good against the Yankees historically, and the Yankees are coming into town next week. So, you know, with that lineup, do you look at mixing him back in right away? or does he need more time? I mean, when he came off from that bullpen session, he seemed to be in good spirits. He was nodding at people as though, you know, he was pleased with how the outing had gone. But, you know, it's hard to say. The Jays haven't said what his next step will be.
Okay, but so what do you read into that then? Like, I know I'm kind of putting you in an awkward spot because you're a reporter and I'm asking you to kind of dance the line here a little bit. But, yeah, if we're talking about bringing him back against the Yankees because he's had success and we're not getting the clear updates, that does kind of lead me into the, oh, so you guys think that this is mental, like there's a chunk of this that's mental.
You know, I think it's more physical than mental. You know, for any player who's not performing, there's going to be a mental side of that, and they're going to be frustrated. I think with Ryu, probably more so than a lot of players, he has had so much success, and he has certainly overcome his own adversity, even at the major league level. I don't get the sense that this is someone who's you know, totally lost confidence in himself. I think it's more that, you know, the results just aren't there. And, you know, clearly there's the forearm inflammation and he's got to rest and recover there. But I haven't heard people around the team suggest that there's a mental side that's worrying.
What about Nate Pearson too? So he's been resting and recovering as well from mono, and he's another question mark. Is there any new updates with him and when the Blue Jays might see him being able to return to full form and then potentially come up with the team?
Yeah, he's getting a little closer, which is a good sign for the Jays because they'll need all the arms they can get. And Pearson, this is a couple days ago, he threw a bullpen session up to about 26 pitches. So, you know, that's one and a bit innings, basically. They would like him in a bit more of a bulk role. So there's more to come on that front. I mean, he's certainly not stretched to the point that, you know, he could pitch three innings or four innings. I mean, at that point, you got to be up to 60 pitches, 50 pitches. So he's got some more work to do. That work continues right now in Florida. And if it goes well, then he'll be back at some point. But, you know, his return isn't really imminent. And I think probably of the three, you know, Ryu, you know, progressing, and Teoscar is probably getting a little bit closer. Danny Jansen too has been working out around the team. So they have some guys coming back, but to me, Pearson and Jansen might be the ones that are furthest away.
So let's think optimistically about Pearson, and he comes back, and whether it's Stripling holding down that spot or Ryu's back in some form, what does this bulky role, to use the quote that's been going around, what does that look like functionally in the second half of the season for, like, let's say Pearson comes back, you know, late June, early July, what does that bulky role entail for him?
Yeah, I mean, and I think they would hopefully, you know, want him back earlier than that. I mean, I think best case, he could be back at some point in May. But yeah, whenever that is, I think that he could follow, you know, let's say Jose Berríos has an outing like he did on opening day, and you got to get through, you know, the second through the fifth innings, then you could go to someone like Pearson. Or Kikuchi only makes it through four and a third, and you need to bridge the middle innings, or you're playing extra innings, or, you know, someone like Ryu comes back and he's not fully stretched out and you need to bridge those innings. So it's almost really like the Trent Thornton role that we saw last night, and, you know, it didn't go so well. So, you know, and Thornton has been, he stepped up, he's done a good job for this team, but, you know, let's face it, he doesn't throw 100 miles an hour like Nate Pearson. And so that extra 5 or 6 miles an hour might help him miss a few bats, and that could make the difference in some of those games.
Okay, so at the risk of being, you know, Mr. Blue Jays hot take guy, I think the question has to be asked. What has to happen for them to switch things up with Bo? Like, it's now 81 ABs, right? Like, it's not an inconsequential amount where you're in a bit of a slump here. Like, it's pretty routine now. The OPS still sits under 600. Do you just leave him in that spot for how long? Like, what changes, if anything, before you start to go, okay, something has to change?
Yeah, well, definitely the results are not there. If I'm the Jays, I'm looking at it less through the lens of where he's hitting in the lineup and more through the lens of what's going on here. And what I'm seeing, at least, you know, you look at the games, you look at some of the numbers, certainly seems as though he's struggling to hit fastballs right now. And that's kind of surprising because last year he was a great fastball hitter. Coming up, he's been a great fastball hitter. So you know the bat speed is there. He's certainly not someone who's going to be overpowered by a 95 or 100 mile an hour fastball historically. But this year, the results are really not good. You look at some of the batting average, slugging percentage against fastballs this year, it's very low. He's hitting off speed pretty well, but he's not hitting fastballs. You look at some of the swings, and they highlighted this, Tabby highlighted this on the broadcast the other day. Some of the swings, he's just not getting around fully. He's late. He's not getting the bat through the zone on fastballs. So there's some sort of a timing issue right there. And we're not the only ones who are seeing that. Opposing pitchers are seeing that. And now you look at the percentage of pitches that Bo Bichette is facing that are fastballs, it's spiking. So pitchers are saying, all right, we're going to keep attacking you with fastballs until you prove us that you can hit them. So to me, if I'm the Jays, that's the core question. It's not really where he hits, but it's what's going on here, because he has the bat speed, he has the ability, and yet he's not catching up to the fastball. So that's central to what's happening with Bichette right now.
So if you're Bo, how do you pull out of that? Because, you know, you don't want him to lose that aggression, because jumping on bad pitches early is part of where he's had so much success. But also, like, I could see this being like a pretty vicious cycle where he's having trouble managing counts and managing the strike zone. So they pound him more fastballs, and then he's not getting around on them. So they pound him more fastballs, and he knows he's going to get a lot of fastballs. So he's even more aggressive. How do you step back from that if you're Bo Bichette and kind of, you know, reset your approach?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I mean, the good news is he's got the bat speed to do it. He's got the ability. So, and I mean, we saw it like 3 days ago. He's hitting a grand slam in a huge spot. So, you know, there's no question. It's not like he needs to do something that he's never done before. It's not like he needs to do something that he doesn't have the physical skills to do or the mental skills to do. He can do it. There's no doubt about that. And Bo Bichette knows that he can do it. So it's less a question of, oh, okay, now he has to jump into this territory that he's never done. It's more, how do you get back to that spot? And that's, I mean, guarantee, you know, Guillermo Martinez and Hunter Mentz and the Blue Jays hitting coaches are looking at that very closely and working with Bo Bichette on that. I don't know exactly what that looks like, but he can hit a major league fastball. It just hasn't been happening so far this year.
Yeah, it's such a weird position to be in right now, because it's like the Jays they've been winning games, and yet you feel like there's so much more for them to do, right? Like, they haven't had Teoscar Hernandez, they haven't had Danny Jansen, although you could argue that's been a blessing in the sense of they have seemingly discovered something for a while in Collins, right? Like, it's hard to believe that they'd be getting more from Jansen than Collins. Maybe the same, but more, I don't know. That seems kind of tough. But then you have Bo struggling, you have Chapman struggling on top of those two things, and you go, what would this lineup look like if some of these guys start to hit? The question is, like, with Bo, you said it. Hey, he's going to catch up to things. He's going to be fine. How do you feel about Chapman? Because if you're looking at his numbers from last year, they're, like, dead in line with the guy that he was, like, right now, or the guy that he is right now. And so people went, hey, this is someone who's going to bounce back, and that's what they've done with A's players. And, hey, Semien struggled out of the gate last year too. But yesterday they drop him below Tapia in the lineup, and I think that kind of sparks in my mind, at least, where I go, I wonder if we're as confident that this guy was the quote-unquote necessarily bounce-back candidate and not closer to what we saw last year, which is a guy whose OPS dropped like more than, I think, about 100 points from what his career average is.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly no guarantee that every time the Blue Jays get an A's infielder, he's just going to turn into this offensive machine. And, you know, we've kind of been spoiled here in Toronto watching Josh Donaldson and Marcus Semien, of course. I mean, those guys, that's kind of the best case scenario when you have an MVP and someone who hits the all-time record for second baseman home runs in a season. I mean, that's, you're not going to get better than that. And so with Chapman, to me, when I look at him, yeah, you're probably expecting a 230 hitter who has some power. And I'm not seeing anything really to believe that there's a huge difference. Like, my expectations remain pretty consistent and have all season when it comes to him offensively. Now, you know, defensively, stating the obvious, I mean, we all see it. This guy is incredible defensively, and he's got an amazing arm, and he makes good decisions, and he's got good footwork, and just he's an incredible defender at third base. But offensively, I'm not expecting him to turn it around and be someone that we're, you know, saying should be batting second in this lineup.
Yeah, and look, with Chapman, there are some positive indicators on the plate discipline side. He's actually, this feels insane to say, but he's actually striking out less than he has the last couple seasons. If there's going to be some regression in that stat, look out for your enjoyment watching him. Speaking of enjoyment watching, Ben, Alek Manoah on the hill today, 3:07 start. We've got Raptors 76ers game 6 at 7:00 as well. Tell me Alek Manoah is going to work quickly and we're going to have a game in the style of Monday's game so that we can all be, I mean, in my case at the arena, but in other people's cases, cozy on the couch or cozy at the bar in time for Raptors 76ers.
I should know this, but is it a home game for the Raptors tonight?
It sure is.
Wow. I mean, I could see if Manoah pitches really well, I could see him sitting courtside after. Like, I bet that, you know,
like that's
like a low-key prediction for the day. He's someone who really enjoys, you know, basketball, saw at a lot of Heat games in the offseason.
Yeah, he's going to be torn next round after the Raptors pull this comeback off. Who's he going to cheer for?
He won't be torn. He'll cheer for his Heat, and then he'll pretend like he's cheering for Toronto, but any real fan is going to cheer for their team.
That's a Drake move.
He'll show up with a split Kyle Lowry jersey, half Raptors, half Heat, do the Gurriel family thing.
But yeah, I do think that you know, anytime Manoah's on the mound, good chance of a quick game. That game the other day, it's a 2-hour game. That was incredible. And you know, we're all baseball fans here. You know, I enjoy a 3-hour game, but there's something about like a 2-hour 20-minute game, 2-hour 30-minute game. It's the best. It is so good.
Yeah, we were spoiled with the Halliday years and a little bit of Mark Burley. You need a little bit of that in there. With Manoah, 3-0 start, ERA of 2, strikeout an inning. I mean, I know at this point it's a little bit of like we you know who you have in Alek Manoah, but that feels a little weird because he's a sophomore. He didn't even have a full rookie season. Is there more for him to tap into? That feels silly to say when he has a 2 ERA so far and he was so good as a rookie. But it feels like very quickly the expectation of Alek Manoah has settled in as, oh yeah, he's going to be really good every time out.
Yeah, less than a year into his major league career, less than a full year. And you almost just group him with Berríos and Gausman and say, okay, you've got 3 starters at the top of this rotation that you expect incredible results and consistency from. And it's because Manoah's been so good when he has taken the mound in the major leagues. I mean, there's something like 19-4 when he takes the mound, and it's not a coincidence. He's got some really good pitches, developing changeup, great slider, great fastball, really willing to attack hitters within the zone. I think that like any pitcher, there's always stuff that he can work on. And for someone who, you know, hits a lot of batters, you don't like that. That's just giving up free base runners. You probably want to, you know, improve the command a little bit. I'm not sure exactly what goes into that or why he's hit batters periodically, but you know, that's something that if that's 10 base runners a year and 3 of those come around to score, that can make a difference in a game or two. So those are little things. There are always little things, whether it's holding runners, whether it's pitch sequencing. He's like most pitchers, he's still somewhat of a work in progress, but to get to this point where the results are this good this early, the Jays are obviously thrilled with what he brings, and the results even right now are that of a frontline starter.
Yeah, dude, that's the best thing you can say is, what does he need to do to improve? And you go, I don't know, hit a few less batters?
Yeah,
it's like, well, that's pretty good. That's a pretty good place to start. And honestly, I'll admit, I kind of like it. It's just he's this huge, imposing guy, and every once in a while he works one in on your hands or he smokes. I don't mind it. I don't mind it. If you're gonna put base runners on, do it that way. You know, that's my path. Hey, how do you get on base against Alek Manoah? Well, you wear one. Good. That's fine. I can live with that.
Maybe this is unique to me, but it's the old MLB The Show thing of like, if I'm running the score up on my younger brother, you know, I'll give him a base runner to just like throw at his guy a little bit. I know Manoah's not doing it intentionally, but hey, the better you pitch, the more wiggle room you have to be aggressive like that.
Well, it's better for the pitch count than a base on balls. So yeah, I guess we'll give him that.
Ben Nicholson Smith, thank you for the time today. We always appreciate your cheer and vigor in the morning.
Anytime. My pleasure.
See you, buddy. Ben Nicholson-Smith, that's our editor, our baseball editor here at Sportsnet, okay? You want something edited? you want Blake Murphy when he's eventually, you know, going to write something baseball? You know he's going to do it. You know during the summer, after the Raptors maybe, I don't know, losing six in the Eastern Conference Final, that he pivots over and he does a little baseball article. He's going to have to get edited by Ben Nicholson Smith. And, of course, the podcast is at the letters, and you know it, because if you watch a Blue Jays game, they promote it, and they promote it for good reason. It's a very good podcast. Yeah, I'm always excited to see Manoah live, and part of that is when you go in person, and this is usually a reserved for NBA thing. Actually, it happens in hockey, too. In the NHL, when you always go live, you always go, oh, wow, these guys are bigger than you think they are, right? You go, wow, it would hurt getting hit by one of those dudes at 30 miles per hour or however fast this game. That would suck. But Manoah is the rare baseball player where when you show up to the ballpark and you watch him step on the mound, you go, oh, my God, he's a mountain. This guy is a monster. He's a beast. And so that, you know, what Ben just referenced there about him hitting batters, of course you actually do want him to course correct a little bit, but I actually never minded it because, A, it's the only way that you're getting on against him, and B, he's the type of guy that when he's hitting dudes, it starts to frustrate them, and then you've seen guys bark at him, and I go, what are you going to do about it, though? Like, you're going to go at him? You're going to go at that 6'7 guy? I'm going to pound you into the dirt? No way. They don't fight in baseball, but if they ever did...
You know what's going to hurt worse than that fastball?
Yeah.
Alec Manoah powerbombing you in the infield.
If we ever had a... What was that movie called? The Quest with Jean-Claude Van Damme. Yeah,
that's a movie.
Who didn't love that movie? That's our age. That's a prime choice. That's a prime cut action movie.
Did you not see the Mets and the Cardinals' big bench brawl yesterday because they kept getting hit by balls?
Yeah, but that's what I mean. They don't fight. They're all chickens.
We throw each other around and wrestle.
Yeah, you do a little wrestling from time to time. If we had the Quest in baseball, Manoah would 100% be our representative. And I feel like there's a good shot that we would win the Quest. The Quest, Ailish, was a movie in the 90s with Jean-Claude Van Damme where every country got... a representative. It's basically what inspired the UFC. But
also, like, credit to Jean-Claude Van Damme for knowing exactly what the audience is. Like, Bloodsport's a huge success in the 80s, mm-hmm. and Kickboxer's a huge success in the 80s. And then he's like, you know what? I'm going to cut out all the middlemen. Yeah. I'm going to direct this myself, and we're going to get rid of the storylines, and we're just going to do a bunch of cool fights at the Kumite.
Yeah. And guess what? It's better than the other ones. It's actually, I like Bloodsport a lot. I was a big Van Damme guy. I love Hard Target, for example. Like, I know the Van Damme deep cuts, all right? So don't come to me not thinking I don't know Van Damme. The Quest is better than Bloodsport.
The Quest has a 14% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, again, you know what Rotten Tomatoes gets?
86% too low.
Yeah, and you know what the Rotten Tomatoes is?
That
I wish I had a Rotten Tomatoes score for Rotten Tomatoes, the site. Yeah. They have, like, Tommy Boy is, like, 2% on Rotten Tomatoes. They have no credibility.
14% on Rotten Tomatoes, that's double what Who's Your Caddy has. So
well,
the Quest is doing just fine here as far as movies we mention on the show today go. Let's take a break. Let's get back into some Raptors 76ers stuff with Vivek Jacob of Raptors.com and CBC Sports. That's next on the Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590, The Fan.